Hey there, this is Scriptlock, where we go on about storytelling in video games. I'm Nick Folkman.
And I'm Max Folkman. Today's guests are Brooke Meggs and Sam Walshlager. Brooke is a freelance writer and designer. She is the recipient of the 2017 MCV Pacific Xbox Women in Games Creative Impact Award and has worked on Paperback, Florence, and The Gardens Between. Sam is a writer and narrative designer. Her credits include Sumo Boy, Fallout Lone Star, Star Wars The Old Republic, and Mass Effect Andromeda, and she's just joined ArenaNet as a narrative designer. Thanks for coming on the show, you two.
Thanks for having us.
So, Sam, we'll start with you. How did you break into the video game industry?
Oh, gosh. It was kind of a weird roundabout way. I started out majoring in film in college, and then I got on my first film set and discovered that I hated it, just absolutely hated it. and I had already graduated college and I felt like I'd wasted my degree and everything. And I got kind of in a funk. And then my brother suggested video games, like playing them as a way to sort of get out of that funk. And he set me down in front of his Xbox and had me play Mass Effect. And then, at the end of playing the whole trilogy, and it took me like only 2 weeks. I burned through them like 13 hours a day. And at the end of that, it was intense. But by the end of it, I knew what I wanted to do. And so I sort of switched gears and I went on the internet on Reddit, on ModDB, on all of those websites, and I sort of just offered my services for free, and then I worked up to sort of freelancing for little indie games and visual novels and stuff, and then I did mods in my free time, and that was sort of what got me attention from BioWare, and I just sort of worked my way up from there.
Okay, I have a bunch of questions. First, what did you hate about working on film sets?
The people. Film is such a collaborative effort, but it seems like every person is out for themselves. And I was on a film set for like 2 days total, and I just saw it so clearly that like this was not for me.
I was gonna say, because we started working in film too, and it certainly is that, and a lot of film production are like that, where they have to be such go-getters and be out for themselves, but they're still, it is similar to video games in the collaboration aspect and how like everyone bunches together and works together, especially in the visual effects part of the film industry.
Yeah, I mean, I heard that, you know, like post-production and everything is a little more chill when it comes to the film industry, but yeah, it seems like you're always hustling, like you're always having to sell yourself, and that has to be so exhausting.
It totally is, especially if you freelance for video game writing.
Oh, yeah. That was also very exhausting.
When you got out of college, had you not played video games before then?
I had played them, but it was sort of a case of when we were growing up, it wasn't that we weren't allowed to have video games, but we were sort of discouraged from having them. It was sort of like, go read a book instead. And I sort of didn't have really the desire to fight that. And then my brother was the one who was sort of like, no, I'm going to play games. And he kind of got through to them a little bit. And I played like Pokemon, and I played a lot of the original Star Wars Battlefront games. But I didn't play the newer stuff like PS3, Xbox 360 and beyond until I had graduated college.
Okay. And just because I've never heard of anyone binging the Mass Effect trilogy before, how was that, and how was like experiencing the story that way?
Gosh, I mean, I don't have much to compare. Well, no, I can compare it to how I played Dragon Age, which was over a longer span of time. It was not, you think it would be really daunting to play some that amount of content in that short of a time, but it really, it wasn't. And I think it was because each of the three games is quite a bit different from each other. So you're definitely playing a new game each time. And, I mean, I did. It got to the point where I had to back off a little bit because I was starting to play and, I guess by extension, design quests for it in my sleep. And I was like, okay, I think we're playing a little too much now.
What kind of quest were you designing?
Oh, God, I don't even remember. You know, when you're like half asleep and things just don't even make sense. I think there was, if I remember, there was something about like a Vorcha in love with a Hanar or something.
I want that quest. I want more Hanar quests.
Oh, I know. I love the Hanar. I love the Elcor too.
Oh my God.
Was it a mod specifically that got you the BioWare job?
Was that quest I designed in my sleep?
No, well, like, did you submit like a mod as a writing sample specifically, or?
The writing samples I submitted, I actually didn't do a Mass Effect one because it's really funny because at the time it felt like that was so like holy and untouchable to me, which is funny because then I ended up writing a Mass Effect game. But yeah, at the time I was like, I can't touch Mass Effect, like that's insane. So I ended up doing. They asked for one sample, and I did two of them. The first one was for Star Wars The Old Republic, because that was, you know, I knew that if I had were to be hired, it would be on that game. And then the other one to sort of show that I could do a broad range was for Dragon Age Inquisition.
And what was the writing test like? What did they ask you to do?
They asked us to do, it was, you know, it was right on the application website. So, okay. it was in the listing, but, we had to make, a Twine quest and we had to make, you know, the different quest branches and everything and dialogue and, like dialogue choices and branches within the quest and everything. We had to make all of that into Twine and just make a little kind of a game. And I think that's a really cool way to do it because, you know, every other place that I've applied, they've just had you send in, you know, a screenplay. And yeah. I think that sending in a Twine sample really shows that you know how to work within interactivity. And I think that was really good because I could kind of show that I had been doing that for a while and that I knew what I was doing. And yeah, I really liked that version of a writing sample.
Cool. And Brooke, how did you get into the industry?
Well, in a very roundabout way. Games were one of the main ways that I experienced story as a kid. I was either on my bed reading books or on the couch playing games. But it never occurred to me that it was something that I could do for a living. I was writing in a lot of like online role-playing forums and things like that. So it was definitely there, but I decided because I had this fascination with digital media, I did a multimedia degree thinking I wanted to be a web designer. And then had a similar epiphany to Sam and realized that that is absolutely not what I wanted to do. But a part of the course, you were allowed to pick some electives. So I chose some creative writing subjects and then found myself in a room with all of these other people who wanted to write and people teaching writing. And it was amazing and I loved it. So I did professional writing and editing course after that, which was more of and I took every creative subject that I could. I took one in film writing, script writing, one in short story writing, in novel writing, and then editing and I guess more structural and then the sort of details of editing. And while I was doing that, I was teaching game studies at a university in user experience design. And we were looking, and that was cool because we were looking at games like they were texts. So we were applying philosophy to games, but as well on the user experience side on, you know, how people experience. That one was more focused on web, but we eventually branched out into games and had a couple of classes on games specifically. And I, you know, was quite vocal with some friends about, you know, really wanting to write for games. And someone recommended me to the Voxel Agents. They were starting on a new game that they knew they wanted to be narrative driven, but they also wanted to reach out to artists from outside of games. So they weren't specifically looking for a game writer. They were looking for a writer who, I guess, had the same, had aspirations, but also worked well with the team. So I sent them a short story and then came in and met with them, and we like consulted with them and brainstormed a little bit about some storylines. And then they asked me to come back. So I was there 1 to 2 days a week, which turned into 5 days a week, because as I guess the writer and main communicator, I was also helping writing copy for press releases and helping with emails and box copy and submissions into awards and things like that. All the other writing tasks, I suppose, on top of doing story bibles and character profiles for that particular game, which is The Gardens Between. And that's how I started writing for games. It's basically awesome. All just naturally kind of moved into one another. It was very organic, which makes it sound like magic, but it wasn't really.
It was
a lot of hard work. It does, yeah.
I have a few questions about this, Brooke. So what kinds of when you were teaching, what kinds of games were you teaching about?
We were part of that subject. The students made board games, so that was very cool. So we studied some board games and looked at them, being Pandemic, Ticket to Ride, a number of those. And we sort of purposely started there so that the students didn't immediately jump to wanting to talk about all the AAA games and thinking that that's all that games were.
Yeah.
And then we moved into talking about, applying feminism to any kind of game. One of the main ones, we looked at different games for different purposes. So we looked at, Street Fighter, and we looked at Grand Theft Auto was a big one at the time because of all the things going on around that game in terms of portrayals of women and violence and things like that, because there was a bit of a, effects theory sort of study that we could do on that, whereas, the same thing that happened with TV and radio essentially was happening with video games at the time, so we were speaking about that. So a big range of them, because the students could take the philosophies that we were teaching, or the theories, and apply it to a game of their own. So after that, the essays were a joy to read because they were all, my favourite games the different students had picked, from, Assassin's Creed to, Assassin's Creed and Orientalism to, you're testing me now, BioShock and Andran's work. And things like that. So it was very cool.
Would you be looking into the stories of games at all, or more to design aspects?
Bit of both. Sometimes we would have a narrative studies focus for some of the classes, and then for others, we would look at the design of the game. My memory's a bit rusty, but the lecturer would talk about Foucault's idea of the panopticon, and then talk about how we police each other when we play video games. So the behavior that you have in the lounge room when you're sitting next to people, and if you make a mistake, you kind of, regulate your own behavior in the way that you play. So we looked at narrative, like in games, but also behavior around playing and playing games, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And when you went to work for the Voxel Agents.
Yes.
Why weren't they looking for a game writer? Were they think game writers were too aware of the constraints of development, and that's why they wanted another writer?
I think because they wanted, from what I understand, to people from outside the industry to bring fresh ideas, and not necessarily for narrative be grounded in, for example, quest lines, or having a necessarily active way of thinking about the story, which is funny because with my background, I sort of, I guess, naturally had that understanding anyway. So I definitely brought that. But then I think, the idea for The Gardens Between was initially the mechanic was prototyped with Little Red Riding Hood, and the story that I had submitted was a twisted fairy tale. So I think that resonated particularly well. And so we decided that we wanted to tell our own story. And I had a lot of aspirations for, you know, telling a story about a friendship. And I think that resonated well. So I don't think it was necessarily about not specifically wanting a games writer, but wanting a writer who knew about games but wasn't necessarily steeped in the way of writing them, I guess.
That makes sense. And we'll get into The Gardens Between in a bit.
Cool.
But first, Sam, were you writing when you were younger, before you were gone to film?
I was, yeah. So I was that weird little kid who was, like, always working on a novel. and it was... That's not weird at all. I was, like, you know, and I was, like, 9 years old. So it was, you know, about different colored unicorns and stuff. But... yeah, I was always writing stuff, and I was like, I was the kid in elementary school who was like, you know, the teachers would always be like, "Oh, your stories are so creative," and but you know what, you never think that it's a real possibility, you know, like you hear, oh, you're good at writing, and you're like, oh, well, I guess, you know, if I wanted to, I don't know, write articles, then, you know, maybe I could go down that career path. But otherwise, you know, being a writer isn't viable. And, you know, I think especially when you grow up in the Midwest, you're kind of told that, you know, you got to stick to a path and then don't deviate from it. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you've experienced that too. So it wasn't really until in college, when I was like deep into college, that I was like, oh, I think writing can be a job, maybe, kind of.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting because I guess college opens you up to a new group of people and studying writing and thinking about writing, or at least storytelling in different ways. Like, it wasn't until I got to doing that professional writing and editing course, and there were people writing their books and actually taking that very seriously. And I was like, oh, this is a thing.
Yeah, exactly.
We only realized it because we also grew up in the Midwest, and because no one else wanted to be writers in our school. So we thought, like, I guess we can't really do it either. And then the writer of Jurassic Park came and visited our school because he used to be an alumni.
Oh, that's like, so cool.
Oh my God.
The movie, not the book.
Yeah, the movie. And we're like, oh my God, this guy used to grow up in our neighborhood. Like, we could do this actually. And that was probably the biggest thing on why we got into this industry.
Wow. Yeah, it really helps to be so able funny. To see how other writers do it, or that they exist.
Yeah,
and just seeing, you know, other people dedicate themselves to these, you know, beautiful, strange, fictitious universes, and you realize you're not the only one.
Yeah.
Sam, did your film degree help at all with your video game work?
Oh, it absolutely did, because I actually, so, you know, you major in film, and then there aren't really official tracks or focuses, but you sort of make your own focus just sort of through the classes you take and through, you know, what you're doing on the side. And mine was writing. And I was screenwriting so much that screenwriting is way closer to game writing than, like, writing novels is. And so just the fact that I was able to think visually and think in terms of dialogue and not prose was incredibly helpful.
And thinking in terms of editing too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, getting into edit bays was a good crash course and prepares you for game tools. And, you know, when when you're in a game engine and it breaks down, and you're like, oh, I've been here before.
Happy sigh.
Yeah.
What's your writing process like? Just in general.
I was just talking about this actually with someone else. I don't really outline. Like I have sort of a goal that I want to get to, and then I have maybe some major steps along the way, but I kind of do things a little more like go with the flow than I think a lot of other writers do. And I've noticed that when I collaborate with other writers, it kind of makes them nervous. Yeah, it's not something that a lot of people do, but for some reason my brain cannot outline in a detailed way. And I gotta know once I'm deep in there where I'm going. It's weird.
Okay, so I have a question about that.
Yeah.
So the reason I don't like to do that is because I'm always I don't want to waste a lot of time. And like, if I'm just going to go down this road, I know maybe where I'll end up, but I don't know how I'm going to get there. Then I'm just going to waste a lot of time that I'll throw out later. So when you're doing this, do you end up throwing out a lot of stuff, or does it all end up being useful?
I mean, you always end up throwing away some stuff, but I just, you know, nothing's ever wasted, because if you didn't do it the wrong way, then you wouldn't know how to do it the right way. You wouldn't know that the other way feels better.
True.
Yeah. And if you have an end goal in mind and you're not just like, let's see what comes out in the end, then, you know, you're a little less likely to go really off track since you have something in your sights already.
Brooke, is this similar to your writing process?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I don't, likewise, don't outline a lot or in a very detailed way. The reason being is because often I'll have a character in mind or a voice or mainly a person who I want to find out more about, which I usually do by then thinking about the kind of environment that would serve, you know, to help bring that out. So I sort of see them in a place and then think about how to move them through. So how their actions or reactions or situations and then the mechanics that tie to that will suit their journey, which eventually reveals itself, I guess, which requires a bit of rewriting once that actually happens. So I think I'm very character driven, which means that when I start to think about, like, I have scenes that pop up, so in the outline I'll put those scenes down, but I definitely go through a lot of reshuffling of scenes to find the right, I guess, sequence of events that bring out the things in that character that I want to bring out or that reveal that conflict or that problem that they're having.
Has your process changed since you got into writing for games?
Yeah, I think so. I think that because I've gone back to writing a novel in between the freelance games work that I'm doing, and they definitely feed on each other, because I think when I write my novel, I'm a little bit more loose and abstract, whereas with games, there's not that luxury, which is also a good thing, because I have to outline and be very specific about what's happening and what's going on. So because a lot of consulting I do is coming in on a game that already has some weight to it and has a narrative to it and that has mechanics in place, a lot of what I'm doing is thinking about what the core themes are that I'm picking up on and if they're resonating with the mechanics, first of all, and second of all, with the aspirations of the team. So, and how they're currently being articulated through level design, art, character, personality, and the actions of the characters, but also the players. So I start to get very structural about it and very, I sort of go, okay, well, let's chart the player experience and think about what the character's currently experiencing and, like, start to pull out spreadsheets and graphs and ask big questions like, so what is your game about? And then I go, I think I should actually try this on myself when I'm writing my book, because I would definitely probably get a completely different perspective. But also, having said that, the book itself is very, I guess, iterative and scene-based, so it doesn't have these long passages of prose. It's very in and out situationally. very much like a game. Yeah. So, yeah, it's definitely helped a lot, I think, both. But they're completely different disciplines. You're right, Sam, when you were saying that film writing is closer to game writing, absolutely. Like, I think novel writing is definitely a different zone.
Sam, has your writing process evolved since you got into games too?
Yeah, in a way. It's because it's interesting because writing, when you're writing a game, you're never just creating something on your own.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a lot more of adapting your methods and your style to whatever would best suit the team as a whole. And so while I personally would maybe prefer to just sort of see where things go and you know, dive in and evolve something naturally, that's often definitely not what would benefit the team. And because, you know, there's designers who need level information, there's, you know, cinematic artists who need information for their team. And so, you know, like, it's a lot more you sitting down with a group and collaborating and coming up with an outline and a set of rules together, and then me just sort of, you know, going back on my own and elaborating on that by myself. And so that's a lot different.
I want to piggyback off a bit on what Brooke said about starting with character in her writing process. And Sam, when I first contacted you about coming on the podcast, you said you'd be interested in talking about how character should be made a priority over a plot when it comes to games. So first, why should that be?
So it's something I feel really strongly about. And I think that it's not so much character over plot. It's that character should be the plot. And because, you know, when it's funny when you ask people about what they liked about a game's story and what their favorite parts are, it is overwhelmingly almost always a character moment or a favorite character, or, you know, I was so sad when this character died, or, you know, like, I loved the banter between these two people while I was running around inside the game. And so it's, and I think it's a reflection on the fact that in real life, people are what we care about too. It's not, you know, I can't recount what I did today detailed, but, you know, I can probably recount a conversation I had with someone. And so I think our brains are wired more to enjoy human interaction and to remember it more than events. And so when you're thinking about the story for a game, you need to dial into what affects humans the most and what people will remember. And I think that a memorable character is going to impact someone for a lot longer than, you know, a plot twist, for example.
And it's also those characters when they have those deep, well-rounded personalities and defining, you know, quips and, you know, conversations, they're what make the plot unique. They're what make it interesting. So, you know, you can have the same plot with many different types of characters, like one plot with one lot of characters and then the same plot with a different lot of characters, and things will unfold differently. The narrative beats might essentially be the same, but they can still be inherently different stories because the characters are so well drawn.
And there's also the fact that, you know, every plot has been done ever. Like, there's no way that you can come up with an original plot, but it's a lot harder to make the same character twice just because people are so nuanced. And so I think that helps a lot too.
And also people do things for a reason. You know, a lot of actions come from, you know, our beliefs or our values or our relationships with people, or, you know, a bind that we're in, whether it's an action or a reaction. You know, we lash out or we consider, or all of those things, you know, result in an action or give an action meaning as well. Yeah. So I think, yeah, definitely interesting characters.
Do you think that most story-based games today prioritize plot over characters?
No, I don't think so. I think that the ones that are, well, the ones that are considered really good story-based games, I think, without perhaps even realizing it, prioritize character. And it's not even this conscious decision like we're going to put character first over plot. It's that if you take the time to really flesh out your characters and you know, make them into fully realized people, even if they're not actually people, then you know, you're automatically worlds ahead of, you know, the games that just tell you a story and you know, use archetypes and that's about it.
Yeah.
Do you mind if I ask a question? Sam, do you, or all of you, do you have some good go-to methods for creating those well-rounded characters? Do you, like, what are those things you think about first when you are getting to know your character?
So I am like the world's most notorious people watcher. I have been known while out with friends to accidentally completely ignore them because I'm watching the people at the next table. And I tend to like take observations from real life people and put them into the characters that I make because it's, I mean, I don't flatter myself enough to think that I can create something that's better than the quirks that I've seen in real human beings. Yeah. So it's, yeah, I like to start with even if it's like a fantastical, you know, sci-fi alien person, I like to start with somebody that I either know in real life or like somebody that I've, you know, seen like a public figure or something and sort of start from that and then build outwards.
Yeah, awesome.
When you're out in public, like with friends or family, do you write down, if someone says something like, that's amazing, do you write down immediately to use it for later?
Oh, yeah. I have a note section in my phone that's just all random quotes from people that I've never even actually met in real life, like just listening to out in public.
So do we.
Ours is mostly relatives.
Yeah. Going home for holidays is like a treasure.
Oh, yeah. So true.
Yes. Oh, man. My grandmother is from Russia, and, you know, she's very English as a second language. And so she says some things that I think I will remember for the rest of my life because they made me laugh so hard. It's so good.
I was going to say the last thing I wrote down was from our grandmother, and it was, he should have known better. He's the son of an orthodontist.
Oh, that's so good. Oh, man. Yeah. That's really good. I love that.
Love you, Grandma. She doesn't have to listen to this.
But
I should call you.
To answer Brooke's question, I try to start with one flaw for a character, and even if it doesn't become...
Yeah.
A focal point, like it doesn't come out in dialogue or anything. I just like to try to bridge the characteristics of that character out from the flaw and see how that goes. It might not work, but it's a good starting point.
No, I think that's valid because, you know, and there's this sort of hokey thing that I learned in college that sort of stuck with me, even though it's a little cheesy, but, you know, you always create a contradiction in a character. Like, you know, maybe somebody... loves animals but, you know, can't stand the thought of having a pet or something like that, and it's sort of like a cheat code to making an interesting character.
Yeah, definitely.
I usually work backwards. I don't know how it started, but I'm more of a plot person first, coming up with stories. Games is different, but like most stories I write, I'm plot first, and I like trying to figure out what characters would fit best with the story, and then it's like starting with the basic, like what the character is, and then figuring out what's the worst thing that can happen to that character.
Ooh.
Within the story. I'm having a rough time right now with a story where like I have the plot set out, but just trying to figure out like what to, and I know what the character is, but just trying to get backstory, I've had a real hard time with it, so I'm just listening to tips when talking here.
Well, one thing I do when I'm stuck is I make myself write lists. So first I'll brainstorm a list of lists. So it's like 10 secrets that all my characters are keeping, a list of scenes that I have not written yet that I probably should write, a list of questions about the story I'm writing that I'm too scared to ask myself. And then so I basically just think of all these things that I could write, and then I start to write them. And just recently I wrote a couple of lists of the secrets that characters are keeping, and that's been really good because some of them aren't secrets, they're just obvious things that perhaps only myself and the character know, but also the secrets that they keep from other people often, you know, provides a lot of that, you know, meaty stuff, you know, that has to do with flaws, like you're saying, and what they want and worse things that could happen to them and contradictions and things like that. That's one of the things I've been doing lately.
You just reminded me of something that I've done once where I don't know what it's called, but it's building a character based on parts of their body where it's like you start with the head, which is, I think I'm going to mix this, all this up if someone looks it up, but the head would be, what is their outward facing goals? Like, what do they want to do? But what they tell people they want to do. And then like their arms are how they interact with the world. Their crotch is, what is their real urges? I've done that kind of thing once for like trying to build a character, and it seemed like it helped, but it just takes a lot of work. So I haven't done it since then.
We'll try to put a link to it in the show notes for listeners.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a benefit to drawing your characters out and with as much detail, but sometimes leaving them a bit flexible is good too, because like you say, the plot might dictate a character that needs to do this. Or, for example, you might create a character in this way, but then the rest of the characters in the story is kind of saying, maybe that character doesn't belong, but that's okay too, I think. Or when you start to realize you can't draw enough detail into a character, they might not be important, or they might need to merge with other characters.
Yeah,
definitely. But it's definitely a good way to assess that, I think.
I was going to ask, do either of you, or have you done the... where you do a biography of your characters beforehand, like do a complete, here's their entire background and like physical characteristics and everything before you would start writing?
I should, but I don't.
Yeah, I should too. I mean, when I used to do role-playing online, it wasn't like D&D or anything where you needed to roll dice, but you definitely had someone who set out a plot and then you auditioned a character that you put together. So, for example, you would have to go through and say who your character was, like from, you know, a brief physical description, then a bio, and then their background, any abilities they might have. And you always had to make sure you weren't creating this god character to enter the game. So you needed to give them enough flaws, but you also needed them to be interesting for the world that the game master was auditioning for. So funnily enough, that's how I started doing things, but that's not how I do things at the moment. Like I definitely haven't started that way for some time, but I think doing those lists and doing those, thinking about what the worst thing can happen to them is definitely worth, you know, starting a bio for and putting all of that in there. Something I might start to do again.
I was just curious because I've never done it, but it always seemed like it would be helpful, but I would worry about, okay, I would define something really early, then I would be constricted by it and not be able to explore more in the actual writing of whatever I'm doing.
Yeah. Yeah,
there's something I
think
do,
so.
There's something I do instead that it's a little more flexible, and I think it works a little better for, you know, writing things in the moment, is I make a list of scenarios that could happen and how that character would react to them. And then, you know, if there's like a larger cast, I write sort of sample arguments between the characters and sample conversations between the characters to sort of flesh out what their relationship to each other might be and how they sort of jive with each other once they're thrown into this story together. And I think that it's less concrete, and I think that it helps make a little bit more of a fluid character, I suppose.
And that's just like a good exercise for writing too.
Yeah.
For characterization.
Yeah, definitely. That's a great idea.
And then I want to backtrack just to get back onto character and plot. Do either of you think that there ever be a point when you'd want to prioritize plot over character in a game?
I think that it depends on the game, because there, you know, there's a lot of content that you need to write for certain types of games where there's no room for, you know, fun character development. Like, the player needs to know they have to go here, and a plot point needs to move them there. And so in order for it to actually be a game, the plot needs to come first. And, you know, that's sort of the caveat that I have on all of this, you know, like, character needs to come first, is that when it's a game, no, being a game needs to come first.
Mm. Yeah, that's really interesting, because for a long time when we were developing the story for The Gardens Between, we knew we wanted it to be about a friendship between these two people, but the mechanics are moving time forwards and backwards. So you're not moving characters, you're moving time. So you know, we were concerned early on that the player would feel disconnected from the characters. And because there's no text or speech in the game, we can't characterize them with, you know, funny dialogue, or we can't talk about their relationship or their friendship too overtly. And we were having a lot of trouble communicating, first of all, who they are, that they're friends, and what kind of adventure that they're on, and also what they're setting out to do. So a lot of those questions are also game questions, because when a player starts, they're like, what do I do? And then after a while, they're thinking, well, why am I doing this all the time? And hopefully the narrative can play into that and give them context. But we were, I think, for a long time trying to work with a quest plot where they were out to get something or do something specific, or, you know, and that quest plot pairs really well with game design, because you're, you know, starting out on a journey, you collect abilities, you know, level up, quote unquote, as a person, but also as the character, you know, becomes more and more aware of what they're doing and what they want with mentors. And then, you know, they get the thing and you fight the big boss and the game is over. Whereas with us, and not to say that's, you know, all games, but for us, when I came across, when we came across Christopher Booker's Seven Basic Plots, and we found The Voyage and Return, which is very popular for stories like Alice in Wonderland and The Wizard of Oz, where characters fall into a strange world and they don't have this narrative drive as such, but to just be, you know, in awe of the world. And the world is, in fact, a big part of that plot, because it's part of what makes the characters change, because they have a struggle outside the narrative, outside of the surreal world, that they get the tools to solve inside the surreal world. And that resonated with us because The Gardens Between has very beautiful surreal worlds in which the player must move time and observe to solve puzzles. So when we realized that that plot was resonating with the game design, that was a big thing for us, and really unlocked a lot of things in terms of, oh, we don't actually have to portray that they're after something super specific, you know, because when you say characters want to get a thing, you are very much, you know, saying things about what that story was about, and it's not what we wanted it to be about. So it was interesting how plot unlocked some story solutions for us, and a way of talking about the story. So we could use the points in the Voyage and Return plot to talk to each other about what part of the game was serving what narrative beat. So, yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to go on about that.
Great. No, it's perfect.
Totally unlocked all of that for me when we were talking about character and plot. So
you actually wrote a paper called The Writer Between Thieving Literary Plot to Design Game Narrative about your experience on that game.
Yes.
And how you basically went from a writer to a narrative designer. Can you talk about how you made that transition?
Yeah, sure. And that transition very much involved, so being a writer of fiction, I had, you know, these ideas about plot and narrative, but also a way of talking about them, which I'm sure you're all familiar with because of your film background, and you use people like, you know, Robert McKee and all these great people who have thought about story a lot, Joseph Campbell, and you start to use their words, basically their concepts. So I was early on, you know, going, where's the drama? Where's the tension? You know, what's going on? And because it's a calm, meditative game, the team thought that I meant, you know, where's the shooting or where's the action. And it took a while for us to work out how to make conflict inherent in the story but not have it inherent in the game mechanics. So a part of going from writer to narrative designer was learning a language that I could use to communicate the story first to the team and then to the player. So because there is no text or speech, what I do is very much behind the scenes. So I would have to I initially started writing, you know, 10-page story Bibles and documents and things like that. And it was all well and good, but it wasn't really like what you were saying before, Sam, it wasn't showing the team how to show the story. So I, you know, changed tact and started using PowerPoint presentations instead and started putting images up on the wall and talking to, you know, the artist and the animator and the game designer about how, why the narrative beats were important, what the characters' journeys are and what we're showing. So, and also it was an act in being clear and simple, because I think we were trying to be overly complex with the story, and then, you know, we learned a lot about simplifying and how that can be just as good of a story, because we have these oversized objects in the landscapes that help tell the story. So a lot of what I wrote about in that paper was changing my practice, you know, going from a writer with a room of her own to being, you know, in a team in a collaborative way and learning, like you were saying before, Sam, how to write with a team and in a way that makes them feel comfortable and communicate the story to them.
Could you give an example of like something that you got across non-verbally that you were trying to get across the text or speech?
Yeah. Let me think of a specific example. Well, initially, I guess we wanted to get across it, – it's very tricky to get across that when you have a boy and a girl, the nature of their relationship early on. So we talked a lot about the fact that they were friends and how to be clear that they were friends. So we talked about showing them as next-door neighbours and in a cubby house that is – clearly between two houses. We talked a lot about what their personalities are like and how they relate to each other as friends. And so that was shown as Arena always walking out in front and then turning around and getting a bit grumpy at Frent when he takes his time. And so that's, you know, characterizes them, but also kind of clearly shows over time that they are friends and that they're not sweethearts or that they're not brother and sister. But then we also kind of let go of the fact that if people presume they're brother and sister and don't necessarily draw the friends line, that's probably okay too. So there's only so much that you can control. You can't control how people interpret the story.
Are you battling between how much you want to leave open interpretation in the game or how much you want to define for players?
A little bit. I think we know that by showing we're definitely using a lot of objects that were unique to our childhood, and so we probably are making a bit of an assumption that players will pick up on that. But by the same token, whatever memories that they have of their friendships or childhood friendships, we're sort of trusting that they'll bring that to the table and cast those on the story as they read it from the environment. And then I think we do want to be pretty clear on the ending, because I don't know if an abstract open to interpretation ending would necessarily work, but how that the actual meaning of the ending is completely up to the players, and I think that leaving that space is important too.
I have a small sidebar while we're talking about showing and not telling.
Yes.
I heard this joke today that I can't believe I've never heard before from a writer, where despite that all writers talk about how important it is to show not tell, we still call ourselves storytellers.
Yes, that is true.
I can't believe that's never occurred to me.
We don't call ourselves story showers.
I know.
maybe we have to change this. I don't know.
That's really creepy. Funny, though. Well, because in games, you definitely show a story instead of tell it, because it's, you know, it's all in moving pictures and experiences, and it's funny.
I want to switch topics for a second, because I see we're over halfway through now. Sam, since we haven't had a ton of MMO writers on the podcast, we'd love to hear what it was like working on The Old Republic and the challenges that you faced that were specific to working on MMOs. Like, what was the writing process like on Old Republic?
So one of the biggest differences, I think, between writing for MMOs and for other games is that it's always on a cycle, and it's always on like a continuous content release. So you have to always be continuing a story indefinitely. And it always has to be, you know, you come out with a piece of the story, you know, once every couple of months. And so you never have this downtime where you think and you sort of ruminate on things and you take a break, and you're always going, and it's closer to writing for a TV show than for a movie. And you have to sort of stretch a story out much further than you would even in, you know, a trilogy of games. And I think that's probably the biggest difference is just how often you have to release content and how long that has to go.
Do you find you're always looking for ways to keep a story open, but as well as close a narrative arc?
Yeah, definitely. It's funny because every time you introduce a character, you always find yourself thinking, oh no, we're going to have to bring that character back in a couple of years. Like, every new character you introduce has to find its way into the bigger narrative as a whole, or it's not going to make sense. And, you know, you're always going to have to bring them back eventually, or kill them, you know, like, like, that's like a TV show too. You know, you find yourself with too big of a cast eventually, and you gotta kill a couple of them off. And yeah, it's interesting because you do have to create this balance between having a really satisfying ending to an expansion or to an arc while still understanding that the story is going to continue at some point. And it's tough. It's not easy.
Did you have multiple teams on the game working on different stories at the same time, or was mostly like focused on one story, then moving on to the next one when that was done, and so on?
So at BioWare, the writers were always quite a bit ahead of the other teams. We would always be writing one or two chapters ahead of what, you know, like the designers were working on and stuff. Which got to be a little tough sometimes because games are so collaborative, and sometimes it did feel a little bit like we were writing in a bubble. But we sort of mitigated that by, you know, having designers in meetings with us and everything so that we could catch problems early on. But other than that, the cinematics team always tended to work on different pieces of content, but designers tended to stay in these sort of pods. And it was, you know, sort of like a group, like a small group would do one chapter, and then when that was done, they would move on as an entire group to a new chapter. And so getting to stay with that little group sort of created this sense of continuity that might not have been there otherwise, and it might have been a little disjointed if it hadn't been, you know the people that you're working with really well.
How many writers and narrative designers were there?
So at its highest on the Old Republic, I think when I was there, at least, there was a lot more on the main game. But on the expansions, there were four writers for Kotet. And then that number went down a little bit as people went over to other projects and stuff. But yeah, for the most part, Kotet was four writers.
I don't know why I expected more, but I guess I did.
Each expansion wasn't an entire game, so it was you know, more bite-sized content pieces, and it was a lot of work for each person, but it wasn't unmanageable. Mass Effect had a lot more writers than that.
How many more?
Oh gosh. I think at its highest point, maybe 12, if I'm counting right.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. It's a big game.
Was one writer in charge of a side character?
Yeah, mostly. So each writer would own one or two, like, squad mates or, you know, crew people. But then, you know, all of us would write content that involved those characters. It wasn't like if you were writing, you know, a side quest on a planet and you had to have, you know, like Vetra say something. It wasn't like, oh, get Vetra's writer in here. She's the only one who can write Vetra lines. That would have been insane. But yeah, for like, you know, a character's romance, loyalty mission, everything in that vein would all be one writer, so that it was like a cohesive character.
And since you played all three games before, like back to back, which character, if you had worked on those games, would you single out to write on?
Oh man, I think so.
There's only one answer, and his name is Thane.
Really? Oh man, I love Thane, but I am the world's biggest supporter of all robots of all kind. So I think my choice would be Legion. However, I think Legion is so well written that I wouldn't want to mess him up.
I can see that.
I would have accepted Garrus too.
Oh, Garrus. See, Garrus is untouchable to me because, like, I am so deeply in love with Garrus that it's not even funny.
Brooke, did you play Mass Effect?
I have to admit that it is on my pile of shame, and I feel, like, deeply embarrassed to admit that right now.
No, it's huge, for the first game. Time. That's like amazing.
I know, I'm kind of jealous.
I obviously have an amazing, wondrous 2 weeks ahead of me, Sam, steeped 13 hours a day in Mass Effect. Is that how you would recommend enjoying that series?
Yes.
That's a good question.
Yes. Okay.
I would say I'm going to have to
block out my calendar for the Mass Effect series.
Yeah, but I mean, you gotta really block it out. Like, if you wanna knock it out,
you gotta commit. You're saying it's a commitment.
Yeah, it's like you wake up, you get some coffee, you play Mass Effect, and then you go to bed.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. I'll pre-prepare meals so that I can.
Yeah.
Are you serious, Sam? Would you actually recommend that? Like, that's a really good way to enjoy the series.
I'm not saying
in a judging way. I'm just really curious.
That's a good question. I mean, I think it would be just as fun if you enjoyed it like a normal human being who isn't like hating yourself. Like,
or emerging 2 weeks later going, I'm on Earth.
Like, my God, what year is it? No, I don't think it's funny because I don't binge like anything else ever, and I haven't binged anything since then. No, that's not true. I binged Persona, but I think that there's some games that you can just enjoy, like whether you take your time or you binge it, and it's nice that you got options.
Yeah.
Amazing. Which took longer, Persona 5 or Mass Effect Trilogy?
Oh man. Gosh, you know, that's actually hard to, I think Mass Effect Trilogy, but not by much. Like, I sink lot of hours into Persona.
We're 20 hours into it.
So just to warn you, my playtime was like 130 hours.
Wow.
Oh, I'm turning it down to easy. I'm just going to go for the story. I'm not going to.
Oh, that's expecting like 200. That's what mine was too. Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah. But it's so worth it. Like, every second is just amazing.
We'll get back to it.
All right.
So I have a question. What do you think about, you know, obviously long-form RPGs aren't going anywhere and they're amazing, but I think there's certainly something to be said for games that are doing the episodic content and episodic release that has these amazing, like, two-hour experiences that fit in. It is very much like television. What do you... Did any of you have experience writing on those games, and does it change the way the narrative is constructed?
I think episodic only works if they commit to putting it out on a regular schedule.
Yeah.
So you can keep momentum up.
It's so hard on the development teams. Like, because we were doing on The Old Republic, we were doing a monthly cadence of releases for a while there. Yeah, and right. It's so hard, and it's so, like, you crunch and you crunch and you stress and you get one out, and then you turn around and you're like, all right, it's time to do this all over again. And it's just like, I think from a consumer standpoint, it's really, really fun to have you know, that little update to the story to look forward to, and I really enjoy playing those games, but I feel like I'm a little scarred because I have been on the other end of it.
Yeah,
it's also like, as a kid growing up, I loved 300-hour RPGs that you could play because you could stay with that game for weeks. Oh, forever. And like months.
I know.
Yeah.
But growing up now, it's like, I don't have a lot of time to play games, so I really, really, really appreciate the shorter ones. Like, I can finish this and be really content with it. And so I'll always love, like, Persona 5. I'm going to beat that game. It's going to take me so long. Like, you love Witcher 3. But there's so many games we have that we're never going to beat.
Yeah.
And I want to beat games.
It also means that for me, that big game has to be compelling enough to put in that amount of time, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, it sounds like Mass Effect is definitely, and from what I've seen of it and played little bits here and there of, it is worth the time. But as a writer, as a story person, the thing that I'm searching for is story, and if it doesn't hook me, then that 40 hours or hundreds of hours are not something that I'm willing to invest. I think that's interesting too, just in terms of, as you get older, you have less time, and so then you're like, well...
Yeah,
I got to be really picky about the story here, because if it's not catching me, and that must then, from the other side of it, when you're writing, you're thinking, okay, we've got to make this, like, worth people's while. It's got to be compelling.
Yeah. And it's really hard to sustain that.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just saying it's really hard to sustain, like, that insane amount of effort for that much content. It's hard.
Mm.
And I think, especially since gamers don't finish most games that they buy, most games can and should be cut down, like, or just edited so, like, you're not repeating all the activities you're usually doing.
Definitely. And, yeah, I remember, you know, growing up a number of years ago now, when you would have to literally get past combat just to get some more story. It was part of the reason that I would do it. I'd be like, okay, if I get past, you know, this combat section, I get some story. And that's, you know, what would definitely keep me going in many ways.
Yeah.
And I think games now are better at weaving those two things together, which is really nice.
Yeah. And for as good as Mass Effect is, I would have been happy with no combat in that game.
You would have been happy.
Yeah.
Wow.
I could see that.
If I think of some other game, where isn't there like a story mode difficulty for that game, or is that some other game I'm thinking of?
Not for Mass Effect. Okay, never mind.
No, I think it's something that I think is so interesting and cool about the new Assassin's Creed game, is that there's a mode for people who just want to go through and, like, relax and play the story. And I think
that's really nice. Yeah.
God, I want more games to do that.
Me too. Especially because whenever I'm wanting to introduce someone to games, one of the first things that they say to me is, I'm not very good. Like, I haven't played, I won't be good at this. And sometimes that is legitimately a barrier, because you have to learn how to point and shoot with a controller, and if someone hasn't used a controller before, like they've been all PC or just played games on their phone, there's a little bit of a barrier. So I'll wind up playing and being like, no, just stay with me, just watch. The story's really good. sit next to me. Like, it's good, I promise. And so we'll end up playing through the game together, where I do all the game things. And so it does make sense to me then that games are starting to have more of a story mode attached, where there's not that pressure to, you know, learn and excel in the gameplay too much, I guess. You know, obviously you want a little bit of that, but...
Is that, I'm being devil's advocate, is there a negative to having like a story difficulty mode for a game where if it'll skip or reduce like combat in a game, then should that combat be there to begin with? Like, should the story be more infused with all the other gameplay mechanics that you'd be making easier skipping over?
I think that, I mean, it still has to be a game. And I think that obstacles are a part of games. And I know that most games put obstacles in the way in the form of combat. And so if you remove it altogether, I think that the sense of having obstacles at all would be removed. And then the stakes would seem a little lower.
Yes.
It's a tough puzzle. Yeah.
But couldn't you also, like, you could replace the challenge of combat in a Mass Effect game, which is like the challenge of forming a relationship with an alien, right?
I mean, that's already there.
I know. But you could make, wouldn't you want a system as deep as the combat in Mass Effect for forming and maintaining a relationship with somebody?
Oh, I totally would.
Wouldn't that be the ideal game?
But I also would like to get a game released at some point, too.
I know.
Yeah, the unsaid thing.
Yes,
like,
I would love
it's
that.
It's easier to do combat. The unsaid thing, like in this podcast, in this episode, like everything else is, we've been doing combat for so long in video games, it's easier to do that than like relationship gameplay and like
human condition systems.
Yeah. Human condition systems.
Oh,
and
man.
We're slowly working our way towards it.
I would love to
that
just
sounds amazing.
Dig into that. Yeah, I would love to get a piece of that.
Exactly.
Let me romance a Hanar.
Right? Or just anything, like any game I play. So I could, oh my gosh, I could talk for so long about how angry I am that I could not kiss Nick Valentine in Fallout 4. But
do it right here, right now. We got 20 minutes.
You've got the floor.
Here's my manifesto. No, it's like, I appreciate that there's romance in that game, though. And I wish that more games, because it's so easy to do. It's so easy to put in there. And it doesn't, and like, it's better when it's deep and has, you know, a lot of tie into the game itself. But it doesn't necessarily have to. And it's such an easy, simple thing to do with not a lot of changes to mechanics. And it makes people happy that wouldn't normally play your game otherwise. And I don't understand why more games don't create that romance aspect.
Mm. It's the same thing as putting a dog or a cat in the game and not letting you pet them.
Yeah. Oh my god, yes.
But I mean, the other thing too is it increases your attachment to those characters.
Yeah.
Like I remember, I don't know where this memory comes from, but like I was just thinking of how I've been attached to characters and then something will happen to them and then I will react, you know, because of how I feel about them as opposed to because the game wants me to shoot some things now. And so, like, there's a definite behavior that I have as a player, but then the behavior, when that's reinforced with the behavior that I have as a person and how I feel, that's immediately makes that gameplay, like, more meaningful. And so if you can, and it's not too hard to add in options for romance or, you know, other things like comforting or hugging or, you know, things that allow you to form attachments and then honor those attachments, right? So then let that carry through as a part of the canon, then if possible, then your player behavior is like the way that you interact with the game is more meaningful.
Totally. Okay, we did not play the new Fallout, but Sam, is there like a reason that you can't romance Nick Valentine? Is there a storytelling reason why there wouldn't, or do you
there is, but it's weak.
Okay.
That's all I'm going to say. It's not, it doesn't hold up.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to get back to a written down question while we have some time. Okay. One last BioWare question for Sam.
Yes.
That I'm just curious about, because we've had BioWare people on before, but I've never asked this because you work on different games there. Does BioWare have something like a company-wide defined approach to storytelling? Or did it feel like the dev teams on Old Republic and Mass Effect had a lot of space to handle things in their own way?
That's a good question. I can't really speak for any similarities and differences between, let's say, like Dragon Age and Mass Effect. I think that because Austin is sort of off down, you know, in a different country than you know, the BioWare flagship, we kind of naturally end up doing things a little differently and having our own processes and stuff, and I think that narrative is one of them. I think that one thing that I noticed, and I came on to Andromeda a little late, so I just might not have experienced this with that team, but we tended to do more peer review on the Old Republic and just at the Austin studio in general. We would do table reads of scripts, and we would critique each other, and we would we would give each other feedback at every stage of the process when we were creating these chapters. And it was something that I found really, really useful, especially since I was incredibly new to AAA development. And, you know, it was creating these massive games that I had never really done before. And so to get that level of feedback and that much feedback and also to be listened to thoroughly when I was giving feedback was really, really cool. And I think that was, I mean, it was a difference I observed at least. And I think that they did do that on Mass Effect for the main story content, but I wasn't on the main story content, so I never saw it. But I think there are differences.
Okay. Since we haven't talked about career advice on this podcast for a while, I want to hear from both of you. Because Sam had a thread on Twitter recently.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Your advice, and it was great. And so I just want to hear both of your tips. Like, Sam, could you go over what you said on Twitter?
So, and this all comes from, you know, I've always sort of been really open to answering people's career questions on Twitter and everything. But, you know, recently I got a lot of questions that just didn't really ask for advice the right way. And one of the ones that I saw the most often was that people would make it specifically about, like, how did you get that job and I didn't get that job? And, you know, like, what do you know that I don't know? Like, what did you do that I didn't do? And it when you ask for advice in that way, it really puts people on the spot, and it sort of erases the fact that they did a lot of hard work and you know, built up their skill a lot. And there's sort of this undertone of, like, did you know someone? And the answer is more often than not, no.
Not you.
Yeah. That's what it sounds like a lot. And, you know, when you ask something that way, nobody's going to be that willing to help you. And it's,
No, it's not a great way to ask for advice, is it?
No.
No. It's very entitled sounding. Yeah. And then there's, you know, attached to that, I also get a lot of, and it's insane that I have to say that this is something you shouldn't do, because it should be common sense. But I get a lot of where people will message me and say that they want to become a writer in games because the story in games is terrible and they can make it better. It's like you're single-handedly insulting someone and asking them for help at the same time.
No, you go ahead, Brooke.
I was gonna say, it sounds like something to come out of that is, like, no matter where you're at on your writing journey or on your journey into or through games, like, just being open-minded and respectful and curious and not being, you know, completely, I guess, being open to what other people have to say and what they're doing and respecting what they're doing and taking time to ask them about what they're doing. I mean, it never works for me to go into conversations about careers kind of with a some intention of mining, you know, that nugget of gold or that contact that's just going to get me to the moon. Because first of all, I don't really think that's a thing. And second of all, it's not a legitimate way to connect to someone. So,
I think
just getting to know people and the where they're at in their career, because everyone's career is going to be completely different. So the idea of trying to jump into someone else's career or something exactly like what they're doing is not going to happen anyway.
Because
you're not them. So I think that's something.
Well, if you ask 10 game developers how they got into making games, every person's answer is going to be different. There's no one way to do it.
Everyone's been different on this podcast, but like, obviously, if you want to break into the industry, you have to have some kind of talent, like to write or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe even more than that, it's like, don't be a jerk.
Yes.
Unless you're going to, unless you're going to be like a one man or one person development team, you're going to have to collaborate with people, and people will not want to work with you if you're a jerk. And if they do work with you, you are going to be talked about behind your back, and people will know that you're a jerk, and then you're not going to get more work after that.
The industry is so small. Like, if you make people angry, then, you know, everyone's going to find out about it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say, in terms of, you know, what you were saying about having talent and that kind of thing, you know, so many people come to games writing from different areas of writing and discipline. So having any kind of body of work, no matter what kind of writing it is important, because you're, you know, sharpening your skills as a writer, as a communicator, and then, you know, having, I think you were just saying, Sam, at the start of the podcast that you did a writing test that was to do with Twine. So that's even something that writers can dig into right away.
Yeah, definitely. And I always tell writers to start making mods, because you have tools right there that are ready made for you, and you can tell stories inside of them. And yeah, that was one of the big ways I got started, and I always advise people to make mods.
What mod editor would you recommend?
The Bethesda ones are usually the easiest to get into, and they've got you know, the most to work with. Like I did Fallout and Skyrim.
Mm.
Also, if you're applying to like a AAA studio and they have mod tools, use their mod tools, then apply with that, and then show them that you can use their tool set.
Yes.
A great, yeah, definitely.
And then just go back to, like, interacting with people in general. If you're talking to people in person, especially at a networking event, the person you're talking to can tell if you're just talking to them to give them your business card.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
It's so easy to tell.
Yeah.
Mm.
You can tell when, like, someone's looking at you, and it's like they're collecting you as a trading card.
Yes.
I'm going to get off this talk. I'm going to give you my business card. Then I'm going to leave. And like, you're going to hire me, right? Put in a good word for me.
That's how it works, man. You know?
Yeah.
Don't spoil the secret.
At least I'm assuming, because people were shocked at it, but at least most people haven't had the experience I've had where people ask you career advice and ask you about getting into the industry and then ask you out on a date afterwards.
Oh, no. Oh, my goodness.
For everyone listening, that's a no-no.
Yeah, no. Wow.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit speechless. I don't really know what to say to that.
It's happened more than once.
You can't really... It's like, you can't joke about that because you want to give the impression that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's, I mean, like, I'm laughing. Close. I'm laughing at it. But it's just so bad. Like, it's just bad on every level. Like, don't do that.
It's funny because that's how you get blacklisted.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh,
definitely. Yeah.
Oh, I had one other thing. Oh, let's say you do get talking with someone, you meet them, and like, okay, we'll talk, and it's going well for you. If the person you're talking to does not respond to you quickly, don't get angry.
And do not pester them with more emails.
Yes.
Please. That's true. It does take time to get back to emails and things like that, especially when you meet at a conference and, you know, there's more days of conference plus traveling outside of the conference and things like that. It does take people a while to, you know, power down and get back to their inbox. Mm.
Don't be a jerk. Just be considerate.
Yeah.
Everything comes back to that.
Totally.
Yeah.
And learning good email etiquette takes time to learn, but be conservative.
Yeah.
And that's especially important too, because, you know, being a writer, you know, is learning like also how to be a good communicator, not only of the story, but to other people in the team, like we've been saying today. So, you know, your communication skills are always on display. Like when you're writing an email or when you're, you know, having those face-to-face communications. So, you know, you want to make sure you're setting the tone because you have to be able to, you know, stand up and for example, receive critique, like Sam was saying, on your script, or be open-minded about what other people think about your writing and then provide the same critique. And that's not easy to do at the best of times, but people need to feel safe with you, you know, like because you are writing and also storytelling and, you know, game development in general is a big creative effort and everyone is creative in their own ways. So, and to be creative, you have to be a little bit, you know, vulnerable. So everyone needs to, feel safe with you. And so if you are doing these things that we've said are no-nos, that doesn't send that message.
No.
And if you do end up doing something that's a no-no and you know, you find out in some way that what you did was not okay, like just apologize and don't do it again. And usually people are willing to look past it, but just because I've also had people, if when I politely say like, oh, that's not something that's okay, they double down and they get belligerent, and that just makes it worse. But if you're humble and you apologize and you just move forward professionally, like, people make mistakes. It's fine.
Yeah. We've all been in the position of like when we weren't in the industry, we knew no one. And it's like, it's super hard trying to get in and network, and it's terrifying.
Yeah. And school doesn't teach you networking, and I think it should.
No.
The only advice that we could give is, because Max and I are identical twins and we want to go in the same job, we would go into networking events, we'd be together, and then we would act like we were talking to each other, but we weren't, because we were just scoping out the place and seeing who you wanted to talk to. Because nothing looks worse than one person staying by themselves and like not talking to anyone.
Yeah, that's
someone
really
lurking
tricky
in the back, waiting for their
absolutely
time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So get a wingman. Bring a wing woman. Bring a wing woman. Wing person.
A wing person. Yes.
Yes.
Always having someone to be there. I mean, sometimes I've gone to a, you know, one of those things and just, you know, got a drink of water and walked up to someone and said, I don't know anyone in this room. Is there anyone that you know, and I'm a writer, is there anyone that you would introduce me to? Or something like that, you know, if that seems appropriate. And then you can just sort of get in that way. But you certainly have to be feeling a bit confident by that time.
Yeah.
And I think just in general, in terms of applying for writing positions, you know, making sure you read the job description and provide all the information that's been asked and, you know, all of that communication stuff is good.
Also, don't be afraid if the requirements of the job, like, you don't have all the requirements. Like, apply for it anyways. It's still totally possible that you'll get hired for it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, not many people fit every requirement of a job listing, so they're going to pick the most correct one, and it might be you.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And some of those requirements can be ridiculous.
Yeah.
Okay, did you have any other questions you want to ask? Otherwise, I can do.
We'll do one more then.
Then you do it. You want to do it?
I want to ask. What tools in the storytelling toolbox do both of you feel are overutilized and or underutilized?
I think playing with point of view and perspective is really interesting for me. Like, I really liked, it's an old game now, I liked Fahrenheit 451 and how it did that. So I've been playing around or talking a lot about the role of the narrator with a few projects. So Bastion is also a terrific example of a game that does that really well. And I think exploring the storyteller has been done, you know, really well. with Bastion and those games, but also thinking about point of view and perspective and changing point of view and perspective. And different plots, like what we were talking about earlier, would be something I think is underutilized. So, for example, the romance, how we were saying we wanted some more, you know, romance options in games. The romance is underutilized. The soap opera is a little bit underutilized, but actually becoming a little bit more popular now, I think. They're the two that jump to my mind.
Is there anything that you like to see take a break?
Oh, I've got one.
Your one?
I would love to see games step away from the world is ending and you're the only one who can save it.
Oh, totally. Yes. Yes.
I'm so done with it.
Yeah.
It's, you know, there's so many. Yeah. I mean, there's so many stories to tell. I mean, I kind of come back to The Last of Us a lot, but that's a story where the world has already ended, so it can't get much worse. And it's just a personal story with a personal journey. And, like, if more games could do anything even remotely close to that, I would be so happy.
I think sometimes saving my girlfriend, husband, or something is sometimes not always compelling enough for me to play. Sometimes it's like, oh, they've gone missing and you need to go and find them, but then here are a million other things to do first, so that quest or that need to find that significant other is a little bit undercut by the many other things we can do in the game, because then it doesn't seem like a pressing issue. Like, I can go and get them whenever I need to get them or want to press on with the story. So that premise is a little bit flimsy in that case, or something that I'm convinced I can just pick up later because they'll still be missing.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. So, yeah, sometimes that suspension of disbelief doesn't always carry through as strongly for me because I'm allowed to do other things beforehand. And I wonder what it'd be like to keep that pressure on in a way.
What if that game, your husband or your wife got kidnapped, and then 10 minutes in the game, husband and wife defeats their, like, person who keeps them, then teams up with you for the rest of the game as you two doing adventures again?
Man, that would be amazing. That game so hard.
I would play that. Yeah, exactly.
So would I.
Yeah. They rescued themselves and now let's go and do things. Yeah. Awesome.
Do that in a Mario game. It'd be amazing.
And so many of those, like, Chosen One games would be so much more interesting. It's like, take the Halo games, like, you're the Chosen One Master Chief, but what if I was playing as random Marine or, like, a grunt watching this indestructible person just kill everybody? It's like, even though, like, I don't want to play those games anyway, but I'd be more interested in just, like, trying to survive or just
survive the player character.
Yeah, like, you're just, what your reactions are and how you handle, like, an indestructible force like that going through your world.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Instead
of trying to save something, or if you're going to do those types of tropes again, just play around with, like, the perspective of it.
Perspective and which character you are.
Yeah. I'd love to write a game from the point of view of a villain. Like, you play as a villain. Mm. Your goals are, you know, like, to you, heroic. And, and you know, this typical hero character is the antagonist.
Yep. I want that game.
Yeah.
Definitely. And the villains are often more interesting to play, too, because they have kind of cooler abilities, or they have cooler locations, or they have
they often have better characterization.
Better characterization. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. But also, like, wouldn't that be interesting too, if, like, the decisions that you made, you thought they were really good decisions, but everyone else is just like, what are you doing? That is
exactly.
That is not right. Yeah. You're like, but it is right. I'm pretty convinced. That would be awesome. I would love that.
One could argue the Shadow of Mordor games are that.
Yeah, I can see that.
Enslaving orcs.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you're kind of not the best person in those games.
Yeah. It's not supported by the actual story that much, but...
And the mechanics.
If you just twist it a little bit, that'd be really, really cool.
Yeah, that would be really cool.
On that note, I think we're going to call this. And... So where can people find you two on the internet?
Yeah, well, my website is brookmags.com and my Twitter handle is brook_mags. That's where you can find me.
I am on Twitter, too, @stillnotsam. They finally let me put my full name on Twitter, so I might have to change that handle at some point, but that's what it is right now.
Oh, wow. Good luck.
Yeah.
And you can find this podcast on ScriptLockCast on Twitter. And yeah, that's it.
Great. Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.